Today on Political Rewind, where does America stand in the fight for social justice and equal rights? Our panel looks at the successes and setbacks faced by African Americans and women in the political climate of our day. Playwright Pearl Clegg and CBS cultural commentator Faith Saley join our panel. Political Rewind starts now. Here we go. Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. So glad to have you here. I have to tell you, this conversation is already going on. So let me bring you in on it. We're going to do something a little different on Political Rewind today. We are going to talk politics. We're going to look at the intersection between culture and politics with two special guests who I'll introduce in a minute. Of course, Jim Galloway is here. It's Friday. He's the lead political writer for the AJC. You read him on Wednesdays and Sundays in the Dead Tree edition of the paper. And he oversees the Political Insider blog at AJC.com. Hey, Jim.
It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. I think we're going to just ask a few questions, and then the two old white guys are going to sit back and listen to the women talk about the issues that matter to them. We're also really pleased to have with us again one of our favorite panelists, Patricia Murphy.
Thank you.
She writes for Roll Call, for The Daily Beast, for Garden and Gun. Her column is now syndicated in newspapers across the country.
Yes, any diner on a Sunday, you might be able to pick it up and read it during Eggs and Toast.
Knows Capitol Hill well, has worked for three U.S. senators, two of whom were from Georgia, yes. Sam Nunn and Max Cleland, and now is on the journalistic side. Thanks for being here,
Thanks
Patricia.
For having me.
One of Atlanta's treasures, Pearl Clegg, novelist, playwright, has a show running right now at the Alliance Theater, is also with us. Pearl, it's such a thrill to have you here.
Thank you so much for
your show
me.
At the Alliance. How many shows have you done at the Alliance now?
This is the eighth one.
Okay. Angry, Raucous, and Shamelessly Gorgeous. And in a couple minutes, I want to talk to you about your a really wonderful conceit that you create for the show that I think plays into the theme we're going to talk about today. And Faith Saley is with us, too. She has a play at the Alliance right now, a one-woman show based on a book that you wrote 3+ years ago.
That's right.
Approval Junkie. You just opened the other night.
Yes. I still have that opening night smell.
You know Faith from her appearances on CBS Sunday Morning. You also have probably heard her on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And you have other connections back to public television and radio yep. for many years. So thank you all for being
I'm
here.
I'm thrilled to be
today.
Here. Thank you.
Let me start, if I may, by, again, I said we're going to talk about the intersection of politics and culture. So, Pearl, let me start on the cultural side of things. Your play is about a grand dame of theater or performance art who's now she's in the latter years of her career.
She's 65 years old in her prime.
Okay. But she became famous because she did a performance piece in which she took many of the monologues, most famous monologues from August Wilson's plays, monologues written for men, and did them herself nude on the stage.
Yes.
But let's make the point here. One of the reasons she did that was because August Wilson wrote his best speeches for men. Here's probably the greatest American playwright of the 20th century, certainly right up there. And yet, he wrote for men more than the voices of women. And that's true to some extent, isn't it?
Well, I think it's true, and I think that part of what that piece that she created, Naked Wilson, part of that was talking about the fact that all of those great speeches were for the male characters, yeah. because those were the characters he knew best. And I remember many, many late-night conversations with other African-American women in theater where we were talking and talking about why aren't the women characters as strong. And it dawned on me during one of those conversations that that was not his job. His job was to do exactly what he was doing. My job was to write about the women, was to make those fabulous monologues for women so that I got over being mad at him and started really focusing on the work that I was doing myself. But that's where that Naked Wilson comes out. And it was funny to me because when we were in rehearsal, there were all of these reviews and coming up in a minute articles about Glenda Jackson doing King Lear.
Yeah.
For the same reason that she didn't want to do Cordelia. She wanted to feel those words from King Lear rolling around in her mouth, which is exactly what my character wanted. So I felt like, okay, if it's good enough for Glenda Jackson, it's good enough for me.
So with that in mind, there has also been over the years, and you know that, look, you've 8 plays at the Alliance Theater. You've been your play True West, which was done way back.
Flying West
was done back in the, when did you write
that? 92.
92, and in the following year, it became the most produced play in the country, right?
Yes.
And yet, another part of the theater that we deal with here is that female playwrights have traditionally had a harder time getting their work produced than men. That's been an issue. So it's not just in the writers like in August Wilson, but the theater has been predisposed to male writers, male directors, yes?
Well, I don't think the theater has been predisposed. I think that the men who were running the theaters are predisposed to that. I think it's important to identify the decision-making point and the point where the decisions are made about what goes on the stage of American theaters, that many, many of those theaters were under the direction of men who were their artistic directors, who had much more affinity for the work of male playwrights. So it didn't have anything to do with the theater. It had to do with the men who were in charge of the institutions that were determining what got on the stage and what didn't. So that what had to happen was that decision-making point had to change. Or we had to have enlightened men. Doesn't have to be all women. Has to be enlightened human beings who understand that the stories of women are equally as interesting as the stories that men will tell.
Okay, so I want to ask you, if I can, Faith, I'm going to take just a couple minutes to ask you a couple questions. Then I want Patricia and Jim for you to jump in on this. One of the interesting things about Approval Junkie to me is I don't think that it you necessarily are talking about needing approval as a female issue. And yet, I have to think, given your background, I think you were a high school beauty queen, right?
Well, that's generous, but it was a beauty and talent pageant at public high school, which happens in Atlanta.
North Spring.
You grew up
I was a Spartan, North Spring Spartan.
That's right. We should tell people that you grew up in our community. And yet, I would think that there is a gender factor involved in what you write about.
Yes. At the end of my show, I dedicate what I'm... I have a son and a daughter. They are young. They are 4 and 6. And I dedicate what I'm saying about what I've learned about seeking approval to my daughter. Because, as I say, I think the world won't have changed much by the time you read this. And I think there will still be a million more ways for a woman to gain or lose approval than a man.
I want to just say one more thing and then open it up. You did a piece for CBS Sunday Morning March, Women's Month,
yes.
National Women's Month, yes. Or whatever. Women's History Month,
yep.
Last year.
Yep.
And you made a really interesting observation. Number one, how many more times is a female Supreme Court justice interrupted during court proceedings than a male justice? Do you remember?
It's like... like 30 more times.
Yeah, it was like,
right?
A lot more.
Yeah.
And then you point
like
out...
Like an egregious amount.
Yes.
Basically.
And then you point out that in the first debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, she interrupted him, I think, maybe 7-8 times. He interrupted her like 100.
50 or something. Yeah.
Right.
And also, you know, I'm doing a story for CBS Sunday Morning right now that will probably air on Mother's Day, which is about the lack of female monuments in our country. And there are, I live in New York City, there are 22 real men who are depicted as statues in Central Park, 75% of whom you would never know who they are. And there's Alice in Wonderland is in the park. There are no real women. And there is a statue that will be, we're following this story, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony will be in Central Park in 2020 to mark, the centennial of the suffrage movement.
Patricia,
doesn't
another...
Doesn't say it all.
Yeah, well, and another thing that Faith points out is that her children have never flown into an airport named after a woman in the
That's
United
right.
States.
You know, they're not going to see see many things named for women of the United States until women are in more positions of power in the United States. And that's something we were thinking about, you know, how the show is going to go and what we're talking about. And we're talking about culturally what's happening on the stage, men making the decisions about what sells in a theater. They'll decide what's on the theater. So many times men in politics, many times, forever in history, men in politics have decided for women what their world will look like, what they'll do with their bodies, what options they'll have, what opportunities they'll have. And for the first time in 2018, in state legislatures, in the U.S. House and Senate, these numbers are growing because women are being brought up to say, you can be anything you want, you can do anything you want. And they're actually starting to do that, but it's a lagging indicator. But there won't be monuments, there won't be legislation, there won't even be a society that remotely resembles the real lives of women until more women are at least equitable in that decision-making process.
So, Jim, two things that come out of that for me. Number one, probably one of the most vivid examples of what Patricia is talking about is a photograph we've talked about on this show. It was the group of senators who supported HB 481. I think House members as well.
Just senators. Just the Senate Republican Caucus.
And out front, because she presented the bill, Senator Renee Unterman. Behind her,
33 white men, all Republican. Patricia, you said, I mean, we had, yes, you're right. In November 18, we had a kind of a woman's revolution at the ballot place. But you still have 140 Republican state lawmakers rule the Capitol here in Atlanta. Of those, 17 are women. That's 12%. There are 96 Democrats. 55 are women. That's 57%. The Dems are doing that much better. And that's why you get bills like House Bill 481.
For those people who don't remember, 481, Pearl, is the bill that essentially outlaws abortion in Georgia, which we know now Governor Kemp has every intention of signing.
I think it's terrible. I think the fact that male legislators, male politicians, feel that they have the right to decide questions of women's health, which need to be decided between the woman and her doctor and that woman's family, I think it's outrageous. I think it's terrible. I think it's really a huge step back for Georgia. And I think Governor Kemp and the people that voted for that legislation should be ashamed of themselves.
But you know what's interesting about this, Patricia, is that the AJC has just done released a poll on Friday morning, in which they look at a variety of approval and disapproval numbers. And Governor Kemp, even in the aftermath of his promise to sign this bill, his numbers are up.
His numbers are up. He has not signed the bill yet. And I think if he did a poll...
He's waiting until after the Masters.
Sure.
I'm sure he is. I think if he did a poll of Georgia women to say, did you know that abortion is essentially illegal in your state now? And the governor has just signed this bill that was also passed by the state legislature. I think the majority of Georgia women, frankly, would be shocked. I don't think they really know what's happened in the Georgia legislature. There's wonderful local coverage here in the AJC. It's really not something, though, that I hear my friends and colleagues talking about. It's not really top of mind. I don't think they're going to know until it happens. And I think his approval ratings will be reflected in that.
Is this one of those heartbeat bills?
Yes.
Is it
yes.
6 weeks when yeah. most women don't know they're pregnant at 6 weeks?
Yeah,
exactly.
And if you're not a woman, you don't realize that by the day of your period is week number one. So you're always like 2 weeks ahead of schedule. It's impossible to understand this.
Well, I interviewed Jen Jordan for a piece that I recently did in Roll Call.
I have it right here.
So moving.
Thank you so much. She went up to Washington to testify about legislation that would be on the federal level for a 20-week abortion ban. But she said what she was running into is that a number of men, older men, literally don't know what they're talking about in the Georgia legislature. And she talked to a gentleman, and she said he's a kind-hearted, well-meaning Republican legislator whose wife is a doctor, and she said, well, do you know about this piece about transvaginal ultrasounds? He's sort of, do you know what that is? No. Have you ever talked to your wife about that, who is a doctor? We don't talk about that. And these are a lot of things, a lot of realities that women do not talk about, but men are legislating on. And I think that is going to continue to be a problem, especially for Georgia legislators. I do think some of them are going to lose their seats in 2020 because of this bill.
You know, it's interesting, Jim, when Jen Jordan went into the well of the Senate on the final debate on 481, she gave that passionate speech, which gained her some, at least momentary, maybe longer than that, national attention. It certainly led her to testifying in the Senate Judiciary Committee the other day up there. But she felt a need to apologize that she was about to use graphic language about the reproductive organs of women.
Well, I didn't interpret it as an apology, but I mean, my take on it was she was talking to men in the chamber and said, "You raise this topic, not me. If you want to know how it works, I'm here to tell you."
But that's really kind of my point, Pearl. She was. I think Jim's right. Apology is the wrong word, but she prefaced talking about a female's body with a caution to them, "I didn't start this, you did," which in and of itself is strange.
I think it's strange, and I think part of what you were saying about women don't talk about this, we don't really realize what this bill is doing. I think that so many younger women take their right to choose for granted because they don't remember. And I'm of the generation, I had a friend bleed to death from an illegal abortion in a college dormitory. So that all of these questions are very real to me. And when I talk to young women, they kind of take it for granted that they'll always be able to have birth control. They'll always be able to have the right to choose. And they don't understand that this is a right that has only recently been given to them, granted to them, that we fought for this and that it can be taken away. They don't understand that. And I think that's part of the real danger, is that they're kind of thinking that our lives are fine, everything is fine, we're legally protected, when they are not aware that their rights are being taken away every single day.
All right. So, Faith, the Georgia legislature in 2018 election did add a number of women. How many we elected? 8 new women for the House, I think. I may not have the exact
it's
number.
It's up to 30%.
30% increase. All right. Not bad.
Which, as a baseline. That's
right. Okay. Oh, all right. And we got 118 new women in the U.S. Congress in the 2018 election.
But that's only 25%. That's like, it's so hard to celebrate that. It's so hard for me to celebrate that until it's at least 51%. You know, my son, who was 5 at the time, came home during Women's History Month from his school. It's an all-boys school. He said, "Mom, guess what? Just recently, there were the first 2 African-American female Delta pilots to fly a plane together." And I said, "That's great." And he said, "No, it's not. Why did it take this long?" And I was like, "Oh, thank, if you're our future, little guy, thank you."
I think we would say her son is woke.
He's so woke.
Patricia, you dealt with the issue on the Hill. I mean, you know what it's like. There are days may not be great right now, but there were some pretty bad days for being a young woman on Capitol Hill during your tenure up there.
Well, you know, I think it was very typical on Capitol Hill, as it would have been in a law firm, on a movie set. I think the Georgia legislature, frankly, was and is much worse. But on the Hill and in the Georgia legislature, you have a group of people, predominantly men, making up the rules governing sexual harassment, sexual assault, any kind of infraction between coworkers. And it was only last year that the House and Senate have put together a rules package that even remotely resembles the rest of the United States in terms of sexual harassment. What can members not do? One rule that they finally put in place is you can't use taxpayer dollars to pay hush money to a former aide.
Which was happening up there all the time.
Yeah. All the time. I always had really wonderful bosses. I myself never was sexually harassed. I certainly was probably didn't make as much as the men in the office for the same job, or the other men in the Senate for the same job. And I was told that repeatedly, but you were grateful for the job. And so women have always had to do this balancing act of, I'm here, how much noise can I make until I'm not here anymore? But other women I knew had terrible experiences on Capitol Hill. But it's changing. A lot of those changes are led by female lawmakers. And having Nancy Pelosi as the Speaker of the House is a major, major change culturally. She's been the Speaker before, but a lot of these rules were instituted, the improvements in sexual harassment were instituted under her watch, and certainly under her guidance, the infractions will be punished appropriately, I think.
Let me, just on that point, let me ask you, how does the generational thing work here? Because in November, from November 6th on through January, we had this talk among Democrats that Nancy Pelosi had her turn. And it was time for her to move on and let somebody else take the reins, which, you know, I think Dems now would say that they're very fortunate that that did not happen.
Yes.
But there's got to be that cross current. I found very interesting.
I thought it was really interesting, and it was younger Democrats, men and women, making noise about it. It's time for Pelosi to go. I think that what she did was to demonstrate how good she is at the mechanics of that job. It's a tough job. She's got a divided caucus. Multiple men before her have tried and failed to unite their caucuses.
She strategizes like a boss.
Yeah, she counts the votes. She whips her caucus. I think that, and she whipped every single one of those votes. They didn't give it to her because she was a woman, although it would have been a bad look for Democrats after the Me Too movement. But I think she also went about the work of just whipping every single vote until she had it.
And you know, Jeff, you bring up the generations, and I think that so much of the furor that's been whipped up about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is, apart from politics, it's about the fact that she's a very vocal young woman. I think that is where a lot of the vitriol comes from.
Pearl, you were nodding as Faith said that.
I think that's very true, and I think that part of what is something that's kind of over all of this that I think about too, is that when we say women, and when we say African Americans, we're still assuming that all the women that get elected to office are going to be progressive and are going to be in favor of a woman's right to choose. And I think that what we realize more and more is that women are not a monolithic group. African Americans are not a monolithic group. So you can no longer say, I'm going to vote for the woman, and assume that that woman is going to be someone who agrees with me. You can't say, I'm going to vote for the African-American and assume that that means they're going to agree with me, which is a big change from what, at the beginning of seeing people in these positions, we were so anxious to have a woman there, so anxious to have a black person there, that there was much less discussion about, what do they stand for? What does this woman think about abortion rights? What does this man think about voting rights? Let's look at them specifically within the context of everything they are.
Well, you would make that point about the Democratic presidential field right now. In 2016, you had a binary choice in the general election. You could vote for the female, Hillary Clinton, or a man, Donald Trump. And there are many people who say they made that decision because they didn't want to see a woman as president. To whatever extent that's true, I don't know for a fact. But now you've got five women running for president. They have very different views on any number of issues. So within the Democratic field itself, it isn't any longer, I'm going to pick this woman because she's a woman. I don't want to vote for her because she... You've now suddenly got choice. And even that, isn't that a form of progress?
I think it's absolutely a form of progress. Mm-hmm. I think it's wonderful. I don't want us to all feel like because we're women, we all have to agree and march together. I think we have to all think about what we individually believe in, what is really important to us, and then say that if we're running for office, whatever that might be. I think it's wonderful that there are women with different points of view, but I think that it makes it more difficult for us to do what we used to do and what we think is still the way to go, which is vote for the woman, vote for the one who's most like you. We have to be more specific and more savvy than that.
Right, and to a degree, the success has raised some really interesting questions here. Like, for instance, everybody knows, on the Republican side, it's very hard for a Republican woman to get through a Republican primary. That is, I mean, this is why Karen Handel was the first Republican woman Georgia has ever sent to Congress.
Yeah.
Okay, and she lasted 18 months. But now you've got this interesting situation on the Democratic side where it is going to be very hard for a man to escape a Democratic primary. This is something that John Ossoff, who's contemplating a U.S. Senate race, is going to have to really figure out. Whether his time has actually passed.
Well, the numbers of women voting in Democratic primaries are skewed female, very heavily female.
Yes.
So you've got 56-57% of women voting in these Democratic primaries. So to your point, and also to your point, Pearl, the choices that women have are broader, but they're going to have to start picking along the issues that they really care about, not just I'm picking the woman because she's a woman and I trust her to do everything that I agree with, because we know you don't agree with every woman any more than you agree with your boss and your mother-in-law and every single thing just because they're women.
And if the Democratic candidate ends up for president, ends up being a man, I cannot imagine a scenario in which he will not choose a woman running mate. What do you think? You're the political people.
I think you're right. Absolutely.
I think so. And I think they would be wise to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the times are speaking to that, and somebody like Joe Biden, just throw that out. It's probably one of the weaknesses he has on his ticket is that he's older, whiter, extremely male.
Hey, watch it.
likes to close talk and rub people's shoulders. You know, you're going to have to inoculate yourself with a woman, but there are so many savvy women candidates for him to choose from.
Yeah.
It should not be a hard job.
All right, let's do this. Let's get our first break of the show in. And when we come back, I want it. Jim, we should hear. You know, I've sort of driven the conversation with questions I'm asking. You've weighed in on some. Let's turn it over to the three of you. You tell us what you think the issues are, both in terms of what women are coping with right now. And Pearl, you come out of a family, a father who was an activist for black causes.
And a mother who was also an activist.
And so issues of race and black empowerment have always been important to you. So I want to talk about all of that and let you all drive the conversation when we come back. This is Political Rewind. We're going to take a break right now. See you in a moment.
Hi, I'm Bert Wesley Huffman, Senior Vice President and Chief Development Officer at GPB. This spring, we're trying something new. Instead of taking the time we normally do during an on-air fund drive to ask for your support, we're giving you every minute of your favorite programs. However, as your public radio station, we rely on you to help cover the costs of everything GPB provides for you and your community. So this spring, instead of a traditional fund drive, you'll hear occasional messages reminding you of how essential your support is to GPB. We're calling it GPB's Stealth Drive. It's all about more of what you come to GPB for and less fundraising. No pitch breaks, just short reminders. Think about everything GPB adds to your life and give whatever amount is right for you. Donate online at gpb.org or call 800-222-4788. And thanks.
Because he's only ever seen...
They are continuing... I have no control over this conversation, which is just the way it ought to be, because we are talking to three remarkable women today, Jim Galloway and I are on Political Rewind. Pearl Clegg, who is eight novels. The first one, which was a selection of the Oprah Book Club, right?
It looks like crazy on an ordinary day.
Wow, not bad. Your play, Angry, Raucous, and Shamelessly Gorgeous, is now up at the Alliance Theater. We also have Patricia Murphy, who is, we're thankful, a panelist on our show with some regularity, who writes for Garden and Gun, for Roll Call, for The Daily Beast, syndicated now in papers across country, and Faith Saley, who you see on CBS Sunday Morning doing commentary. You hear her on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on occasion. And she has a play at the Alliance Theater, too, Approval Junkie, based on the book that you wrote.
That's right.
All right. So, Pearl, let me, if I can, start with you. You come out of this activist family that I mentioned before the break. And you talk a lot about... Some of your, you know, your more recent plays have tended to be comedies. Your earlier on, you wrote some of your works were relatively dark. They're wonderful. I mean, I remember.
Was it dark? I don't think of it that way, but go ahead. That wasn't the question you were asking.
I thought Blues from an Alabama Sky was a beautiful play. Dark. All right, so tell me how your work, how you incorporate themes in your work that relate to your activism as someone who believes that we have a lot of sexism in the world and who believes that African Americans have a long way to go to gain the equality they deserve.
Well, I'm in writing novels or writing plays, I'm trying not to make political points.
Sure.
There's always politics in there. But what I try to do is to make sure that the political points that I want to make are coming from the characters I've created. So it's not me kind of moving these chess pieces around saying, okay, now you speak for feminism, now you speak for black people, now you know, but to actually find characters who can tell a story that incorporates these things. And it's not like I have to look around for that. You know, if I'm writing a story about women in the United States, then all the political things that happen in the United States that are directed toward women or that women are involved in, which would be everything, that has to be a part of what that play is. That has to be a part of what that novel is, so that it's not like I think to myself, what political point do I need to make? What I'm always thinking is, what story can I tell that will keep people engaged with these folks for 300 pages or for 2 hours, so that at the end, they like these people. And then the political point will come if I can make them like the people. Going to audiences and readers through their brains is much harder than going through their heart.
Yeah.
If you can make them feel it, then they'll go with
you. Is that the same with voters? I kind of feel like it.
I think it is, which is kind of dangerous when you think about it, because that's why all of that, are you likable, comes in.
Yes.
You know, in a character in a play, it's like, great, I want them to be likable. But it's dangerous when you're looking for a politician and you say, he's so likable, I'll vote for him. And he's really like a monster underneath. He's something else that you didn't even think about because he was so charming. Mm.
I do have to tell one quick story that I think is fun. Your work is usually set in Atlanta, and some of your readers who are Atlantans are very sensitive if you make a mistake here and there. So I know that at one point I don't know if it was one of your novels or plays, but you located a Krispy Kreme donut shop.
That was a novel.
Across the street from a MARTA station. And you heard from a reader who said what?
She said, I loved your book. It was absolutely wonderful, but you got something wrong. And I said, well, what did I get wrong? And she said, the Krispy Kreme is not across from the MARTA station. It is, you know, wherever it is. But I said, that's because when I wrote the book, it was across from the MARTA station. In the year it takes to get it into print, it had moved further down Cascade. And I said to her, I promise, in my next book, I will have the Krispy Kreme in the right place. And I did, because the new one has a drive-thru. And my character drove through the Krispy Kreme.
See, Galloway, you think you hear a lot of grief from readers who don't like what you're saying about politics. Pearl can't even write about a Krispy Kreme without getting jumped on.
But it's never grief. It's never grief. It's always they're telling me with great love because they want me to get it right.
Of course.
Okay, if we can get back just slightly on topic here.
Sure.
You mentioned something very nice. It's the importance of being liked.
Yeah.
With male politicians, it is, do I want to have a beer with them? I mean, that's pretty much. What is it with female politicians?
Yeah, and more broadly, this whole notion of being liked
yeah,
and being an approval junkie.
It's interesting. We took the same tact. I have a part in my show about my experience going on Bill O'Reilly, the show, not the man. And the politics doesn't matter. I was certainly the token liberal asked to come on the show, but. I and my collaborator, director Amanda Watkins, were not interested in making any overt political statement about my experience going on Fox News. The implicit politics for me comes from the idea that the personal is political, and what I share with the audience was my experience going on the show, how that all played out. But afterwards, I say Bill O'Reilly never harassed me, his viewers did. And we share a verbatim hateful email sent to me, just an example of one from a you know Factor fan, and this is what happens when you are a woman in public with a voice. You mentioned that I do commentaries for Sunday Morning. I receive personal attacks, they're not about my opinion. My opinion's fair game, right? They're about how I look. They're about how old I look. They're about how I have to turn the TV or the radio off when I hear your high-pitched, screechy voice. They're about, oh, you're too skinny or you're too fat. You have so many wrinkles. You need to get bangs. I do need to get bangs. I have a gigantic forehead. But other than that...
not as big as mine and Galloway's.
All right, fair enough. But I would lay everything I own on the fact that most men in the public eye are not attacked at least as much for the way they appear and the way they sound as for what they have to say.
Well, and
that's all part of being likable, right? Mm-hmm. Am I palatable to your eye and ear before you can even attempt to absorb what I want to say to you?
Yeah, yeah. And so is that a struggle for women politicians, for candidates?
Then? I mean, I think absolutely, right? Didn't we learn when Hillary was on the road that she had to, well, I guess it's interesting when you're talking about Donald Trump because he does have a whole hair situation going on, but she had to spend so much of her time getting ready to appear in public. Just from a superficial aesthetic point of view. Mm. What's she going to wear? What's her makeup going to look like? And who's going to do her hair, right? I mean, I think that matters with the way we see these women politicians. We had a whole big story about how Amy and I... Klobuchar.
Klobuchar.
Ah, thank you. you know, what she did with her comb. That she ate a you don't know the story, Jeff, how she ate her salad with a comb?
Yeah.
It was like...
Mm-hmm. It was part of that whole body of stories, as you know, Patricia, about staff complaining about how difficult a boss she was to work for.
Yes.
Which apparently is true.
Well, it is true, but there's a special genre of journalism about how awful ex-female boss is on Capitol Hill. And it had been Senator... Mikulski from Maryland. There were legendary stories about how she threw a phone at a staffer. Mm. No, it happened. Yes, it didn't. There are plenty of men who are really terrible bosses on Capitol Hill and in any workplace, but I think the female bosses tend to get the brunt of it because they have to be both authoritative and well-liked at the same time. And I think that in politics it's a struggle. I think that in life it's a struggle. I think that the reason your book and play have such resonance is because every woman probably struggles with being an approval addict because you're sort of taught that's what works for you. That's what works for you.
Smile more.
And if you're a politician on the stump, you're upset, you're angry, you're disgusted about what's happening in the world. It's very hard to be well-liked at the same time. And I think that's a balancing act women are having to do right now.
Jim, I, of course, don't have any personal experience of what Amy Klobuchar's staff has gone through. Apparently, she was very difficult at times to work with. But what was troubling to me about that story was you and I have both covered a lot of men in politics. We can name some of them. Bill Clinton had a ferocious temper and screamed at his staff with some regularity. White Fowler, was very hard to work with. We didn't spend a whole lot of time talking about men in office who were difficult bosses.
No, because men were supposed to be tough.
Yeah.
No, they were supposed to. Tyranny is not such a bad word if you're a male boss.
I think another wrinkle for female politicians, and especially as we're seeing more and more moms who are running for office, and even women who are unmarried running for office. I was listening to Terry Sewell recently. She said the number one question she has gotten since she started into politics is, why aren't you married? When are you going to get a husband?
Wow.
And this is a woman from Selma, represents Selma, went to Princeton, Rhodes Scholar, just an incredibly brilliant woman. And the question for her, and it's more, she said it's not meant to be sexist. They're really worried about her. Like, but what? When will you get married? And so the choices that women are making with their lives, are they moms? Where are your kids? Who's taking care of your kids? This is sort of a whole extra layer that I think younger women in politics are facing that men like Beto O'Rourke can just laugh off and get away with.
I was interested to read, Pearl, that when the big influx of women members of Congress came in the beginning of 2019 for the new Congress, they had to make some changes in the physical layouts of the Capitol. They had to add a baby changing room because there were young mothers now serving in Congress. We should be thrilled.
Yeah. They just added a ladies' restroom, by the way.
That's right.
Did they not change the rules of the House to allow a baby on the floor?
Mm-hmm.
That was just last year.
Nursing mothers.
I was doing a story on first gentlemen, and I interviewed the first gentleman of Rhode Island. The governor of Rhode Island is Gina Raimondo, an old old classmate of mine, not that old, but when I was there, I was still breastfeeding my youngest child, and because there was a female governor, they had installed the most glorious breastfeeding room in the capital of in Providence. Yeah. And unfortunately, that's remarkable. That should be everywhere, especially when there are so many politicians, so many male politicians who are talking about family values.
Yeah. Let me change the subject again, because I said I wanted to hear what your thoughts were on from all of you on what the big issues are right now. Pearl, here we are in April of 2019. We're already in the second quarter of 2019. When it comes to social justice issues, what are you most right now focused on, concerned about, whether it's women or African-American empowerment? What are the things that you would love to see us work on?
I'm concerned about a woman's right to choose, women's health issues very much. I'm concerned about voting rights and suppression of voters. And I'm concerned about immigration. I'm concerned about the fact that we have a country that is prepared to take babies from their mothers and put them all in cages. I'm very concerned about that. And I think that part of what we have to do is to not be overwhelmed by how awful some of these things are, because what happens is we look for a minute and then we look away because we don't want to keep looking. Mm-hmm. And we have to train ourselves to keep looking. What does it mean that voters were in every way discouraged from voting in the state of Georgia because Stacey was in that race and because Governor Kemp was the person in charge of the race he was running in? I think that's something we have to be concerned about. Definitely all the things we've been talking about with women's health. We have to be concerned about that. I've got granddaughters. I don't have to worry about all of those questions with the urgency I did when I was 25. But my grandbabies will, and I want them to have the right to control their bodies. And I want us to do something fair and humane and compassionate about immigration.
You know, we should point out, as you talk about the politics of today, that you were a little piece of a very big milestone in Atlanta politics. You were Maynard Jackson's press secretary during the campaign as well as once he took office, right?
Yes.
So you worked with the first African-American mayor of the city of Atlanta.
And that was the toughest job I ever had. He wasn't a mean boss,
no.
But he was, you know, very willing to call you up at 5 o'clock in the morning and say, did I wake you?
Yeah.
And I was a nursing mother, and I would say, no, of course you didn't wake me. It's like, of course
calls.
You did. Right. Because he would call you. And we were trained to say, no, Mr. Mayor, what can I do for you?
And but did he make you clean his comb after he ate?
No, he was not that. And we knew if he was calling us at 5, he had been up since 3, mm-hmm. so that we didn't feel that he was asking us to do more than he was doing. But that was his entire life. And some of us were 25, 27 years old. We also thought we could do that job and have other lives. And what we realized very quickly is that you can't. It's like theater. It takes up everything. And you have to be very conscious of making space for the people that you love, for your children, for your partner, for whoever that is, because otherwise you'll end up at City Hall from before it opens to after because you're devoted to your boss. Theater, you'll end up there all the time because you want your show to be great. And it's that balancing act that we have to do.
All right. I want to get another break. And when we come back, Faith, we should ask you that question as to what the issues are that you're concerned about right now. And we should point out, Pearl, because we always like balance when we have it on the show, that you worked for Maynard Jackson, who was a proud Democrat. And so you share some of those liberal values.
Oh, absolutely. I was way to the left of Maynard Jackson.
For our listeners out there who know that we try to find balance here, in the show, we have Republicans come on the show who think that Brian Kemp's doing a pretty good job.
I'm sure they do, and I think they're absolutely wrong.
Okay, let's do this. Let's take another break, and when we come back, we're going to talk to Faith Saley about the issues she's concerned about right now. This is Political Rewind.
Support GPB now at 800-222-4788 or gpb.org and receive tickets to see best-selling author David Sedaris before they go on sale to the public. David Sedaris will be at the Fox Theater in Atlanta on November 20th and the Classic Center in Athens on December 4th. You'll also join us for GPB's pre-show reception. Call 800-222-4788 or give online at gpb.org. And thanks.
White and pink clouds of cherry blossoms are one of the hallmarks of spring, and we owe their popularity in the West in part to an intrepid English naturalist. Amira Flatow on Science Friday will meet Collingwood Cherry Ingram. Plus, how do astronauts' genes respond to a year in space? It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Don't miss it. Join us for Science Friday this afternoon at 3 here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Faye Saley, let me do a quick plug before we ask you the question. Your show, Approval Junkie, as we said at the beginning of the show, opened just the other night. Okay. It's up at the Alliance until?
Until April 28th.
April 28th, and there are some tickets still
There are
available.
Some tickets, yes.
Pearl Clegg show, angry, raucous, and gorgeous, shamelessly gorgeous. If you're listening to us on the radio live right now, you've got until Sunday night. If you're watching on TV, you've got till Sunday night, too. But that means only one more performance for you TV viewers, Pearl. All right, Faith, the issues that worry you most right now.
I echo Pearl's concerns. I would also add, just because I fairly recently became a mother in my 40s, I think Elizabeth Warren is doing the most about paid parental mm-hmm. leave, which I think is essential. Before the break, Pearl was talking about how theater can become all-consuming, and this opportunity to do a one-woman show has taken me away from my family and my yeah. young children. But I'm so lucky. I have the support of a babysitter, an incredibly supportive husband. The kids came down with the babysitter, and what is important to me to demonstrate for my children is that mom doesn't work because she just needs to make money. Your mother works because I want to do something meaningful in the world besides, in addition to being your mother. I think it is essential that my children see working mothers all the time. I want my children to go to school with the children of feminists. Because that, and so those kind of political programs are important. We have to make it possible for women to be both mothers and to make a meaningful living. So that's essential to me. I also think that there needs to be a really big cultural conversation around what everybody is calling toxic masculinity. Because having a young son and a young daughter, it's so strange. We give girls in our culture, at least in the social circles I'm in, so much empowerment. My daughter knows she can be anything. And my son is always telling me how lucky girls are. Girls get to wear, why don't they make that sequined shirt for boys, mommy? So I buy him one. But the message for girls is that you can be a unicorn, you can be a surgeon, you can be an astronaut, or you can be a ballerina. But we're not giving our boys the same message that you can be everything and you can feel everything. And our political leaders are not demonstrating how the strength of vulnerability and kindness and compassion.
You know, Patricia, the issue, for instance, Faith talked about child care at the beginning. We should point out that that is not necessarily at all a partisan issue. I mean, it was Ivanka Trump who really, at the beginning of her father's tenure, really wanted to promote a bill that would open doors for child care for families across the country.
Yes. I will say, though, those doors remain closed.
Yeah.
I am skeptical, doubtful, and I would say if I had to list what I'm most concerned about on a policy level, personally, it is the issue of child care. It is having young children and just having a scenario, particularly this is, I think, when the wage gap comes into question, why it's so important for yep. young women to make as much as their male counterparts when they're younger, because when you are married, the partner that makes the most has the precedent in who gets to be working, who gets to go out of town, who
yep.
comes and goes as they want to. Usually the man makes more and the woman makes less, and the woman's career begins to kind of fall away. It just is the reality because
people do the math.
Someone's got to raise these kids, you know, and they're wonderful and they're lovely and they're a gift. But women's careers, and I see it happen again and again, their career, it's a real struggle not to let it fall by the wayside. And the lack of affordable childcare is the reason. It's because women have to work a job to pay for childcare. There have been weeks when I have made less than the babysitter. You know, thankfully now I make more than my babysitter because she works less than I do, actually. But it's a real struggle. There is no policy prescription in place for women with children the way there are that for people who want to get a mortgage, people who want to start a small business, somebody who wants to start a nonprofit. We have entire policy prescriptions for how to make that possible. But I, again, I think because it's mostly men and many well-meaning men who unfortunately just don't get it. They don't know the reality of women trying to work and have kids at the same time.
Jim? Okay, I'll toss in one more, all right? Okay, and we go back to the state capitol here, where you've got a Republican. One of my deepest fears, really, for the last 20 years has been a kind of Georgia drifting into a racially polarized political situation, mm-hmm. where you have all whites on one side, they're all Republican, you have all blacks on the other side, they're all Democrats. But I think it's equally dangerous if you start having a gender polarized political system, where you have all the women on the Democratic side and none of them on the Republican side. I think that's
you
just
think that's
as
a
dangerous.
Danger?
Yes, I do.
I agree. I think it's a danger nationwide.
Everywhere.
I think the voices of Susan Collins, of Lisa Murkowski, they are so essential because they're Republican women and they are moderate women. I think they take a really broad view of policy, a really nuanced view of policy, and they give other conservative Republican women someone to look up to, support, and emulate. But when you have a president who is...
It makes it very hard for Republicans.
It makes it very hard for Republicans to attract female voters.
Yeah, but some of this, look, it precedes President Trump, clearly.
It does. But
Voted in by suburban white women? Wasn't that like the big takeaway?
Well, I mean, it is certainly true that suburban...
and black women voters talk about that a lot.
All right,
yeah.
So Pearl, let's, in terms of that, in the same way Republicans have had trouble attracting African-American voters, they're having a terribly difficult time, and there are Republican women who come on the show and say this routinely, they're having a terribly difficult time recruiting female Republican candidates to run for office.
It's because of the policies of the Republican Party. It's not because people mysteriously say, I don't think I want to be a Republican. It's because the Republican Party and the people that are at the top levels of the Republican Party in our state and in our country have the most awful positions on most issues that we've been talking about.
But it's a circular argument, isn't it? Jim, if you're not going to change your policies if you don't have women of power in your party pushing for change.
If you have a Republican Party that's only male,
yeah,
and it is still in power, then you're going to have bills like House Bill 481 come up. You had the 481 passed through the Senate and through the House in Georgia because there were not enough Republican women in those Republican caucuses and those private discussions to say, no, you're not going to do this.
And the irony, are we just giving up on enlightened men, though? Again, we're making
men
this
like
women's responsibility.
Right. Exactly. We're waiting for your son to grow
that's
up.
Right. He can't vote yet.
That's too long, but that's exactly right.
Where are the progressive men? Like my husband?
Right.
Patricia, I haven't had a chance, and we're starting to run short on time to ask you the big issues right now that you see as you look ahead.
Well, I would say a system of child care that is that supports young moms.
Okay.
Yeah, I really do. Not young. I'm not that young, you know. But that supports moms with young children because you find the reality is that your chance to have children is typically at the zenith of your career when you can really hit the gas and take off.
Yeah,
and it's just it's going to be the thing that holds women back, including running for politics. You cannot run with young children without making some really tough choices that men don't have to make.
Thank you for answering that for the second time.
You know, I think it's interesting that, and I'm always concerned about this, but it never comes up first in my mind when we talk about issues. None of us said climate change. And we're talking about children, and we're going to leave them a world that is so polluted they can't live in it. So that I would like to add to my list of three things that I'm very concerned about climate change.
And which... Jim Galloway, as we watch the 2020 cycle really start to ramp up, is clearly among young voters going to become a crucial issue in both Republican and Democratic Party
politics. Yeah, and you've got Republicans in Georgia who are exceedingly worried about that. that it's going to lock them out of a generation.
Buddy Carter down on the coast
he has admitted that climate change is real.
And
wait, so they're worried that climate change is going to be the issue on which they can't win, or they're worried about climate change, these Republicans?
We have Jim saying that we're seeing a growing awareness among Republicans that there is such a thing
as climate change.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. All right. That's it. We're out of time for today's show.
We solved all those problems.
Yeah, you took care of everything. Pearl Clegg, angry, raucous, and shamelessly gorgeous. Faith Saley, you approval junkie. Thank you, Patricia Murphy.
I think you're over it. I'm okay now.
Jim Galloway, I'll see you again on Monday at 2 o'clock for another edition of Political Rewind. Thanks all of you back there listening to us or watching us on TV for being with us today. See you again Monday at 2.